This is The Big Something. I'm Jake Brownell. Poet and essayist Gary Snyder is something of a living legend. He first rose to prominence in San Francisco in the 1950s as a central figure in the Beat Movement and San Francisco poetry renaissance. He read his poem A Berry Feast at the reading at which Allen Ginsberg debuted the poem Howl, and he was the inspiration for the character Jaffe Ryder in Jack Kerouac's 1958 novel The Dharma Bums. In the more than half century since he broke onto the national stage, he's written many books and has had a profound influence on American culture, not just as a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, but also as an environmental activist, translator of Chinese and Japanese literature, and serious practitioner and proponent of Zen Buddhism. And at 84 years old, he's still writing, with a new collection of poems, This Present Moment, out this month. He was in Colorado Springs to speak at Colorado College for Earth Day. I interviewed him in advance of that talk. Most people will know you first and foremost as a poet, but you've done many things in your career. You've written essays, you're a scholar, you've done a lot of translation, and you're known for your Buddhism as well. And I wonder at this point in your career, how do you think of yourself? Do you think of yourself first and foremost as a poet?
Yeah, with my own, you know, provisos on how people think of poetry and what they think it is about. And I also have to point out that almost 50% of my writing is in prose. And that I've got a number of prose books out, some of which are quite active in the world and have had considerable influence in the environmental movement, and which I value very much. And I find that it is as challenging to me to be writing good prose as it is to be writing poetry, but it is a different kind of exercise.
And so when did you start writing in your life?
Well, all of us started scribbling when we were about in first grade, right? That's writing. You know, making graphic representations of spoken sounds. And language is all, of course, auditory, it's spoken sound. You know, like most people, I was taken by the possibility of the intense little lyric phraseology that children come up with, like, baby, baby, suck your toe all the way to Mexico, or kindergarten baby, wash your face with gravy. That kind of wordplay, children fall into it right away, and they love it. So I took a lot of pleasure in that when I was little, and also storytelling. So I just slipped into writing poems when I was around 15 or 16 out of, and this is where poetry comes from, intense emotional experiences of one sort or another. And most teenagers and most poets in the world, it seems, or many of them anyway, start out by writing poems about their sadness and also about their ecstasy in teenage love.
And that would go for you as well in your early poems?
Well, it's oddly enough, it was not true for me. I started writing poetry about mountaineering. That's what drove me into it. I started doing snow peak mountaineering in the Pacific Northwest when I was 15, and I couldn't get enough of it. Getting up very, very early in the morning and being up on the ice and snow when the daylight first comes, and risking yourself sometimes and all kinds of weird things happening. You never know what to expect. So I loved that, and I wrote some early poems about that. I found out about girls just a little bit later. But then I discovered the poetry that was in books and the poetry that is taught in classes. And, you know, that gave me another perspective. And so I moved on into being more literate and more literary in my writing in my late teens. And also started listening on Folkways records of the blues and the Appalachian folk songs. And I was playing the guitar and singing, and I learned to sing lots and lots of songs. And that was a big help, too.
Part of what your poetry has come to be known for is you seem to be comfortable in the vernacular in terms of kind of speaking simply and writing in terms and using words that would be familiar to kind of the average American. And was that something that you gravitated to early on in terms of the types of poetry and the types of music that you like to listen to and read?
Well, I certainly, I grew up in a working class environment during the Depression up in the Pacific Northwest, and I helped the family farm out by delivering milk from our cows in glass bottles on bicycles. So I certainly knew a lot of people, and I was aware of, you know, how alienating some poetry can be to neighbors and so forth. But in the long term, you know, the poem dictates to you what the language is going to be. And so I have written poems in which I'm happy to say the language is very clear and most people can understand. And I've written other poems that are rather opaque and require more learning. And I mix them up sometimes. You know, like the word frass, F-R-A-S-S, is in one of my recent poems, and it's a poem about splitting firewood. And I find that it's a nice thing to do to tell the audience what frass means.
I'm not familiar with the word frass.
Nobody is, except foresters and woodcutters. It's the brown sawdust powder that is pushed out through the bark of trees by the pine bark beetles that are eating away inside, and it's a sign that your tree has been attacked by pine bark beetles. And once you've got frass on the surface of your pine tree, on the bark, why, you can forget it. The tree's going to die.
Well, if not familiar with that word, I think people in this region will be familiar with that phenomenon at least.
Yeah, so, you know, they've got something to connect it to.
In the early 50s, you moved down to San Francisco and became associated in various ways with the Beat Generation and with the San Francisco poetry renaissance. And there's a quote of yours from an essay that you wrote in 1960 that I just wanted to read that I thought was interesting. And you're kind of talking about that time. And you say, "What we had discovered or rediscovered was that the imagination has a free and spontaneous life of its own, that it can be trusted, that what flows from a spontaneous mind is poetry, and that this is more basic and more revolutionary than any political program based on, quote, civilized abstractions that end up murdering human beings in the name of historical necessity or reason or liberty." I think, you know, in that time and in that place, obviously it was a highly politicized environment in certain ways. And I wonder how, as a young man, you thought about the connection between art and poetry and politics.
Well, everybody that was working in the arts in those days saw the political connections. I would say almost everybody anyway. Certainly the circles I moved with up and down the West Coast, and also my friends from New York, as I gradually met more and more of them, because they turned up on the West Coast, you know. Like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac just turned up. I don't think it's a new discovery. It's in no ways a new discovery, if you look at history, that art and imagination are in the forefront of questioning what the assumed virtue of the official establishment line is. And it is still in the forefront of that. It doesn't have as much effect sometimes as we might want it to have.
When you first began writing and when you were moving in these circles and kind of thinking about art and what it means to be a poet, and also being concerned with issues of politics and morality and, you know, some of the radical politics of the time. Did you struggle at all with kind of wondering how to incorporate those kinds of values and ideas into your work as a poet and to make it still poetry, to make it art rather than something else?
Well, it's what I did. I did exactly what you just said. Did I struggle to? So no, I didn't struggle to do it. I just did it.
You didn't think too much about it. You just kind of did it.
I knew what was necessary, and my academic and scholarly studies and research nailed it all home to me. I was working in anthropology. I went back to 30 or 40,000 BC, 30,000 or 40,000 years ago, to start judging what human beings had been up to. I took a really good look at Native American cultures and how they worked and survived. And then I became interested not only in ancient Mediterranean cultures, but in China and Japan and East Asia. And I saw what was lacking, you know, in the modern world, which is a whole lot. And so I pulled that into my prose writing and wrote essays exploring that and as accurately as I could. And at the same time, I wrote the poems that were generated by of the feelings and insights that went with it.
And for you, what's the distinction between the kind of ideas that make sense for a poem versus the kind of ideas that inspire a prose essay?
That is the critical question for people who are serious writers. And it has to do with the nature of metaphor, the nature of imagery, the choice of language, and the play of the imagination. And so I quote sometimes to make the point, an 18th century haiku poet, whose name was Busan, who said, "It is extremely important to remain unprepared for yourself to write poetry." And that is exactly right. You do not write poetry from deliberate intentions. You write poetry when it comes to you. You can fog yourself to write prose, and you have to sometimes, but a poetry you can't fog yourself to. Either you do it or you don't do it. And, you know, somebody writes you or calls you and says, "Write me an anti-Vietnam War poem." You know, and you say, "Well, I'm waiting for it." But don't count on it till I get it. And so that's always true.
I think your style as a poet, at least at first, it seems very observational. There's a lot of very concrete imagery of things that you seem to be witnessing and in a way kind of bearing witness to, whether it's in the natural world or in human culture or looking at ancient myth or older traditions. So is that for you as a poet, is that part of that being unprepared in terms of just allowing yourself to observe in some way?
Well, that's, you know, that's a kindergarten step is what that is. But you can't even be a bird watcher without having adequate and accurate observations. But learning to be an observer, which translates into, on a slightly larger scale, something that has become very popular in the United States recently, and I completely welcome it, which is the whole idea of the practice of mindfulness. You know, the term mindfulness is a very meaningful term. It means thinking clearly and observing correctly, both. And it means keeping calm. And it means knowing who you are and what your steps are. And so I certainly welcome that. And it is, of course, inspired by Buddhism.
When you first got interested in Buddhism, it was by no means as ubiquitous in American popular culture as it is today. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how you came to Buddhism and why you decided to study it with the kind of rigor that you did.
Well, I came to Buddhism quite simply for ethical reasons, because I discovered that unlike the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, or a bunch of other people, they valued the non-human world of life and are quite clear about that. When they say not to take life, they mean to try not to take any kind of life. It's not that you don't sometimes, it's not that you don't even have to sometimes, but be aware of what you're doing. That is not in the Ten Commandments. And so I started following Buddhist ideas when I was still living on the dairy farm. You know, lamenting the loss of a heifer that had died of some ailment, a heifer that I'd been raising. And then in the Sunday school, asking would the heifer go to heaven and being told no. Heifers don't go to heaven, neither do their cats. And I said, well, heck, I'm out of here, and I left. But then I discovered, you know, by in the literature, both the Chinese and Japanese poetry on the one side, and the sophisticated philosophical texts that were generated by Buddhism in a number of languages, that this is a really marvelous and very intelligent way of trying to understand the world and understand yourself in the world.
And in your poetry, it seems like, you know, one of the things that you return to a lot is observation of the natural world happening, you know, the ways in which animals relate to plants and relate to each other apart from human interference, but also considering human interference.
Yeah, you're right. But, you know, you're overlooking, and a lot of people do overlook, poems that I write that are quite urban, like Walking the New York Bedrock poem. And I distance myself from being called a nature poet. The real world is the real thing, and it's not all nature.
There's a poem that I like from your book, Turtle Island, that, you know, I don't know if you have any of your poems at hand nearby, if you could read this or not, or if I should just read it.
Oh, you're going to, because I'm standing under some trees out in the meadow.
All right, well, I'll be happy to read it. It's called It Pleases.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It pleases. Far above the dome of the Capitol, it's true, a large bird soars against white cloud, wings arced, sailing easy in this humid southern sun-blurred breeze. The dark-suited policeman watches tourist cars. And the center of power is nothing, nothing here. Old white stone domes, strangely quiet people, earth-sky bird patterns, idly interlacing. The world does what it pleases. Washington, D.C., 1973.
Yeah.
That poem, you know, in a way, I think it gets at what you're saying in that it's a nature poem in a way. It's talking about the birds. It's talking about the weather. It's talking about the sun-blurred breeze. But it's also talking about human culture and power as being part of that nature in a way, and also as being kind of ignorant of that nature. It's making a lot of different points through some very subtle observations, I think. That seems kind of emblematic of your style.
Well, you know, that's a very good insight. You know, you picked a very interesting poem, and your analysis of it is quite right. I mean, I can't add much to that except say that I've written whole essays about that topic with more complexity, but the poem does it very nicely. And I wrote a book called The Practice of the Wild, prose book, in which I tried to explore and further define what the meaning of the word wild is, because wild is a process, actually. It's the process of the universe going about its business, temporarily without the agency of human beings. And that's what the world is, and that's what we are. You know, if you are, if you take a Darwinian type evolution as being halfway true, then human beings are a product of the wild process, just like everything else. And it's fascinating to look at that because we don't have to even know how it works in a way, but it is what science enjoys trying to figure out a little bit.
I was interested in something that the poet Michael McClure said about your work, which is he described what you do as in the tradition of wisdom literature, which to me means in the tradition of, say, Lao Tzu and even maybe Rumi, the Sufi mystic poet, or concerned with these kind of spiritual questions on some level and writing for revelation in some way. Is that something that you identify with? Is that a characterization that you identify with?
I try not to be obvious.
What do you mean by that?
I wouldn't write like Rumi. Lao Tzu is probably a kind of poet, that text, but I wouldn't, you know, try to write like that either. One can only write the kind of poetry that you write yourself. And you can't even dictate what it's supposed to be like or how it's going to come out. You know, so my latest book of poems, which is just out right now, called The This Present Moment, it's really different than what I've written before. A lot of it is. One doesn't want to repeat oneself too many times. Or as Peter Coyote says, don't buy your own poster.
That's a good line.
It's a great line.
Gary Snyder, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
That was my conversation with poet and essayist Gary Snyder, who is in town to speak at Colorado College on Earth Day. To hear that interview again, or for more information, head to krcc.org. I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something. We'll be right back.